That's the tough place when you're going to be a person.
Well, I do quite realize that it's not the purpose of this conference to give new answers to how nurses are able to relate to dying patients. But it's a purpose that I'm very, very interested in. So that all the time I was hearing many erudite and obtuse statements, I kept thinking to myself, yes, but what do you say when the patient says? So in order to get you out asking that question, so that I'm not sitting here asking it all by myself, I brought with me from home this morning some patient protocols from my dissertation research. I interviewed a good many terminal patients, most of whom died within 2 to 3 weeks of the interview. Since I assume that we are all, well, everybody's terminal in one way of looking at it, but at least we are all in reasonable health, most of us here, I thought it might be useful to hear some answers from people who were dying, who ostensibly did not know they were dying, but who really did know they were dying. Now, as part of my interview schedule, the last three questions, and I will read the questions once, and then just move through very rapidly some of the answers I got, so you can see what I'm saying when I say, but what do you say to the patient? Because they're all so different. The three questions: do you think much about your religion now? Do you think more about your religion since you've been sick than you used to? Does your church believe in life after death? And then if I got a reasonable answer to that, you know, if it didn't shy away from it, I went on to ask, do you, so that I would have some idea about concept of personal immortality in these terminal patients. Well, I have a beautiful man here. And he, in answer to the question, do you think you are getting better, by the way, he said, no, I can't see I am. He was not as weak as I am. His blood clots keep coming. And nobody had told him anything, but nobody had to. Okay, he says about religion. He says he doesn't feel like doing what he used to. I do know it's wrong when something like this happens. I believe in living a different life now. It would be a lot different. And I asked him if he would pray. And he said, oh, yes. He said, I didn't have to live such a wild life. I've lived a wild life. And he went on about this, so I suggested to him, perhaps you think this was a mistake. And he said, it was a great mistake. And he laughed, and he said, but I hope to go to a better place than this. Now, this is one man, reaction. And he was a delightful man. Now, this lady is less delightful. She went on and on at some length about the fact that she was no doubt getting better, but you could tell she didn't really think so. And on the questions on religion, she said, I went to church for 20 years without missing a Sunday. If you want to pray, pray. I'm sure I pray, if I feel like I want to. Twice since I've been here. This is a period of about 6 weeks. They asked me if I was scared up here or something. I hadn't asked her that, by the way. But I was bleeding, thanks to my nose. I was scared. I said, what would you do? I asked the doctor. He said I was trying to get my strength back too fast. All this is an answer to the questions on religion. And then again, I said about the religion, and she said, oh, I don't know. She said, ask my husband. They go every Sunday. And so then I finally got my nerve up to ask her about her concept of personal immortality, if she believed in a life after death. No, I do not. I believe you're put in that hole, you're there. How can you come alive again? That one was a little difficult to manage. Okay, you think about religion when you're sick. You think about straightening yourself out. I think about dying. I thought about dying when they told me I had cancer. Do you think about it much, I asked him. Don't know you. He said, never been baptized. I went to church, but I'm never baptized. I asked him if he prayed, and he said, when it hurts so bad, I pray. He said, you don't last long with cancer in your lung. I have a friend who died, you know, with cancer in the lung. I asked him what he would do then, since he had brought it up, because biopsy did turn out to be positive. He was waiting for the biopsy, and it did turn out to be positive. He said he'd just go home to his house in 10 acres in Kentucky and wait. Okay, this lady was a religious lady. She believed in prayer. She said, "Oh, sure, I always think about my religion. I like to pray for the dead. Everybody, they need it." She was a Roman Catholic. I asked her about life after death. She said, "I was never there yet. I have to find out. It's ahead of me. If we lead a good life, if we're not sinners, there will be no shame. When I pray to the Lord that He'll direct me the right way, that leading the right way, that's all. If it's God's will, it must be, whatever happens." And this apparently, by the way, referred to life rather than death, this comment about whatever happened. She lost her husband, she missed her daughter, and she missed him dearly. She discusses the death of her daughter. She went on and on about God's will. God gives us the strength to meet all our crises. She talked about her dead daughter, about how much she missed her dead husband, but she had nothing at all for her three living, supportive daughters who were there with her every day. Nothing. About the dead daughter. Oh, wow, this one's much too long. Let me, I don't mean to go on and on. I could go on and on. I want to finish this one that has really a jewel. It's a gem. This is a sister, a missionary sister, a daughter of charity. And she was unbelievable. The people who took care of her, you know, said she was positive there were things on earth. She said that I planned, she told the guy, if God wants me, I'm very glad to go to Him. Now, I'm not scared. She said, I'm working only for Him, and I'm not scared to die. She was a missionary sister in China, and when all of the Chinese wars were going on, she was in very bad shape, tortured, and held for a long time. She was Polish, and she spoke herself of her kind of old-time religion thing. She had absolutely no doubt. She was 68 years old at the time I interviewed her. You know, skin of my hand, with great eyes. She was 10 or 12 days up from surgery, I think a fair academy, but didn't get it all. They went in and took out some and closed you up again. I don't remember the operation, but it was a major operation. And she was just, she was sparkling. You know, she was in tremendous health. But I always think of religion. I think of the community, and I'm with my sisters and working for the people who need help. I'm responsible only for that, for helping people. My appreciation is very deep now, and she got lots of letters from people. She spoke many, many languages. She had a secretary to handle her mail, and she had to handle the mail that came in Chinese and Polish because none of the secretaries could speak that. So I asked her about immortality. And said, yes, but I believe that after death, Christ comes again. She said, I'll die, go to heaven, pass through a better home, pass through the place we belong. God will give resurrection. I'm going to have an old Catholic faith. It's very strong. I'm grateful to God I have faith. I'm grateful I can go back to China. She was, in fact, going back to Taiwan to die. She was, the doctors had given her with the cobalt treatment about 3 months, and she needed it. But from God's hand, I accept anything. If I suffer, I helped the youth, and it took me a little while with this, but I got somebody to interpret it for me. She offered her pain as a prayer for the young people in the world. She said, the youth need help now. Now, you know, I still get goosebumps when I think about it. Somebody like that is not exactly easy to talk to, but it's something you can do and come away from. But somebody like Mrs. She said the thing she said, you know, Sister didn't need anything from the nurse taking care of her, really. But the other lady did. And I still don't know, after this tremendously erudite set of presentations, what to give people like that. This is my reaction.
I think we have gotten stuff what to do. from the conference. And I think that, like, to me, the first session kind of presented us with the problem, and the doctor said, "Listen, he's dying, and I don't know anything," but really kind of confronted us with what his medicine does today. And Dr. Benson and Dr. Potter. To me, both of them said things of what to say and what to do, and of what I myself do when working with, I work in a geriatric hospital, and so on a TB hospital, where people are dying. And to me, the people that I meet, if I put them in categories, if I don't do that, but I just thought about this morning. Like, I guess I would put them in the one of three categories as I meet with people in the terms of their life philosophy. The one group of people that they believe in health. Second group, they believe in death. And the third group, they believe in God. What I mean by that, I think that, and as Mr. Christie said it this morning, I said, it's a favorite theory of mine in dealing with this, is that death is not God, hell is not God, but God is God. And that's the one thing that I have to give, which is my faith in God. That's the one in terms of my conviction. The part of what George said, that's going to be meaningful to be given to people, and of course it's got to be done in the sense of listening to these people, where they are. And to reply to you about the woman who made you feel uncomfortable because she has kind of a negative reaction. And she is one who kind of believes in hell. That really she doesn't believe that God is stronger than hell. She really believes that hell has the last word. I would begin picking up on her fear. And find out, what are you afraid of? So I said, boy, you sound like you are kind of afraid. Eventually, as I said, getting to the point, was sharing with her my conviction that hell is unconscious. Really conscious. And the same, the same with death. Those who believe in death, those to me are the humanists. An example of that is the doctor friend that I made a certain presence at the hospital. He was brought up Roman Catholic in Argentina, Italian. That's all superstition. When you die, you die. So he got cancer and for 3 months faded away. And nobody was really willing, not wanting to talk about the fact that he died. I talked to him a couple of times. And shared with him my anger with God. I had two doctors saying to him, I don't want you to leave. And it kind of flew mad. And it got better in your pocket. But it just didn't, like, but that's when he gave me his response. Okay, Don't worry, because I'm not worried. It's just going to just fade away. I guess that's the way it happened. I get to feel kind of very badly when the term said that he had to die in this way for himself. But I think he could have gotten a lot more out of those last 3 months in terms of his relationship with his wife and being able to say goodbye. Make the most of the time that we have left for him. And sort of taking him down in that way. Just one last thing, I guess, I'll see if I'm right. I just need to be very good. So much to turn out. Yeah. In my own, work with older people, as well as younger people, that I've discovered for myself and my own, what I myself have done, and found that the things of the play that I and the other sort of stuff after Masters and that thing, it shouldn't be a lot. But the people play the game of any doctor a lot. And I think older people that will play the game of any doctor that I'm going to die. Any doctor that I've grown old. Any doctor that I've lost my wife or my husband. And listen to that, and indeed, and picking up on the awfulness of it, that it really is awful of this, isn't it? But I said, we all just confronted with how we're going to spend the rest of our time, whether it's for a minute, 10 years, or 5 months. So we can spend our time playing in with awful and complaining about how awful these things are that have happened. Or we can continue to reach out and make the most of the time that's left with it. And part of that may be scaring. I guess I don't want to see me much at all. But there's several people I've worked with, that I'm saying, you're dying and I want to learn from you what this is like. And for you to share with me that I appreciate that. And I don't know if that's at all. I kind of feel like you're going to say, well, I still haven't got my answer. Which I think is an inside thing to do.
Thank you, Brian. After I finished with the wish of the chairman of the Institute or conference here, that we sort of act as catalysts, either the things we're saying or the things that we will hear after we're finished, catalysts for the rest of you to contribute to ideas and observations to the whole group. And this is sort of what I do or try to do constantly, especially with people that are dying. The things that we just said here in the last few minutes, they sort of, again, reaffirm some of the things I said, a couple of little insights. I know standing out after last night's talk with sister and my two friends here, we, in about 5 or 10 minutes, just talked about a number of things which gave me a chance again to reflect on what other people have learned by dealing with dying patients. So one of the things I'd like to say to you, is kind of thinking out loud, is that whether a person is a nurse or a doctor, any kind of professional working with patients who are dying and their families, to continue to be alert and open and responsive to the the constant things that can be learned, because each law is so unique. I was thinking about that this morning when there were three of us, sitting with one of the other participants in the conference. A Lutheran pastor who's been a Lutheran missionary in India for 41 years, and I just thought how much he must have learned from dealing with people over those years. In ordinary religious ways, the sick, the dying. I know every speaker here that I've heard has given me things to think about. Likewise, those that I've spoken to during time after a football game or over coffee or something like that. I'm just sort of saying that what is worth for me in learning about the dying is sort of an ongoing dialectic, experiencing a little and then reflecting on it, and then experiencing some more and reflecting on that. Trying to be a real student and at the same time trying to assess my own thinking, my own total reaction to life and to death. For instance, at a hospital the size that I work at, and I think I would have to function differently at a larger hospital, I would share the work with another chaplain, but we both get to know every patient in the hospital. I can tell you right now, unless somebody's come in since I've been here in the hospital, we have terminal PA right now. And I try to keep that in mind as I'm going to deal with these patients. I get called for death, and there are people who are to the extreme and are nearing death. And I think to myself on the way, God help me to deal with this situation, this family, this patient. I hope to bring to this situation what my history is. Everything that I've learned and experienced up to this time. And I realize that each one, as you know, some of you, the best experience that is in this room, how many of the nursing sisters, for instance, have dealt with hundreds of dying people. But I'm saying, and repeating over and over again, is I hope that others can learn some scholarship that we have at this conference, from reading, and from their experience, from their observation. I found that we've heard it described here as present, we've heard it described as witness, we've heard it described as prophetic voice during the conference. I think that whether a person is in the role of a chaplain, dressed in clerical garb or not, or a nurse, or anyone that takes an interest in the dying person, how much they can bring to that person by their presence, their concern for, based on the principle that this is a unique, valuable individual. So unique that in their Christian view of things, that Almighty God died for that person. That person represents me also. The fourth apprenticeship, everybody's apprenticeship. And I think if I, and I would hope that others do the same or better, would never let numbers or the consistency of the dying, the quantity of the dying patients, anything like that, the routine, the monotony, the sameness, ever for the vision of that unique person to share. And again, trying to even on every unique person to reflect on one's experience with that person, reflect on the experience of others you see dealing with that person. For instance, I come to know how well some doctors not only deal with the patient, but with the family, and also the ones on the opposite extreme. Some of them will come in with the most sincere compassion for the wife, the husband, the mother, and other ones that don't know what to say, have an autopsy blank in their hand, and it's got the first thing they say. To learn from all of these things, to learn how some of these, how the young nurse, how the old LPN deals with the dying patient, to learn how that patient reacts to that. I just think my role is so very unique, and it's just something that I would hope that a week from tonight, a month from tonight, a year from tonight, I will be able to bring more in the way of knowledge and reflection on that knowledge to that task of not only dealing with the general area of the people who are sick, but with the dying person. How often a person, say, they give an instance in a CMNI, doctor, when you were mentioning how the different ones, I don't believe in this, I believe fully in the religious views and values. I see on several occasions with people that either felt they had no religion, they had fallen away from their religious beliefs, or they were very agnostic in their beliefs, how after they put through a crisis, but having seen an interest in it from a religious point of view, how this reacted on them very favorably. I'm not saying by that they had a conversion of heart, but I wouldn't doubt it. I know from what we can observe and hear that people, that some individuals anyway, who really didn't care whether they lived or died, at least that's what they were voicing. I know that they didn't really believe that, but they were trying to make themselves and perhaps me believe that, how they changed when they saw, as Sister said in the last sentence of her talk this morning, the presence of God in their life by the care that was given to them, or by the touch of the hand, or by a smile, just coming around. A chaplain like we are know this is our duty. The patient doesn't know that this is the duty of the chaplain, that he's getting paid for this, for instance. They think this is marvelous that somebody is coming around and seeing them, filling them up, patting them. And therefore, I do hope that there will be observations from you here in the floor, but I would certainly hope that you are eager to continue experiencing what it is dealing with the dying, reflecting on that, and making that a constant dialectic with yourself.
And the opportunity that the adoration
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm actually saying that, you know, like I said, I meant that as a kind of summary of, as I think of my past theatrics. So I just thought of it this morning. I've never operated this way. No, I never, I don't go in there and wonder what kind of category this place is going to come out. But as I deal with people in medic fields and some officers, but as I know, those who are afraid, and what is it that makes them afraid? That on the one hand, there is some simply to think of it, but they're afraid of, I just hope it doesn't hit when I die. It's a, that's the thing that concerns me the most. So that's, I'm not worried about anything else. I just hope it didn't pay for it. And I think that that's the real thing, and it's that I can give them good information, and the doctor can give them good information, that, hey, this can be made so that you don't have to worry about it being painful. But, that's the kind of a, well, that would be a person who's to need some to see itself. Yeah. The thing is, how do you deal with the fear? How the people experience. What's the answer? The question is, what's the answer to the fear? How do you help a person to overcome fear? And certainly one way is to very much agree, being right next to them and being with them in the midst of it, without even saying any words, you're saying, hey, you don't have to be afraid. I hear everything that you're saying, and like, it's not terrifying me. Maybe the person, hey, how come it doesn't terrify you? One person I am. You know, and so are you.
I'm in the same immediately, urgently, right now.
I think that, and you need to deal with that. And the reason that I'm not afraid is because I believe God is stronger. His love for me is stronger than the death that's going to happen. It's going to be a rigorous thing and whatever it is. And God is stronger than the hell. And by all, in all that category, I put in all the extremes of guilt for the terrible things I've done in my life up to this day. And that God has said, hey, you're guilty, you really are guilty, but I still love you. And that person is just a kind of a famous one. That could be just a very simple thing. God really likes you. If you really believe it, it's perfect love passed out to you. It really does. And if God is really for you, there's really nothing to be afraid of.
I don't know. Be willing to admit that. But, two-thirds of the people who die in this country, more than two-thirds die in institutions. Out of that more than two-thirds who die in an institution, something like half, and these are sloppy statistical statements, but they do, are not religious in any immediate sense of the word. That is, they don't want to talk about it, or they don't understand what you mean. And how do you say to somebody like that, God is love?
I think that's a good thing. I'm
Let me make clear that when I was asking these questions, I was not operating as a nurse in a situation. I was operating as a researcher. What you do as a nurse is what I see done and what I have done is try to be there when the questions are beginning to be asked, but having don't do them. But you can be there and not walk away all the time. Maybe.
This is Bobby had said so the first thing I see that you said about people know that I think we really felt ourselves out. They get all kind of the signals from people when it's all some tough time. And they know. And it doesn't, all you have to do is begin to ask, well, what's the trouble? And I was defined against me, but, you know, I was instructed. And don't tell him. He's got a terminal cancer, don't tell him. The wife doesn't want to know. And so I went in and I said, what's the trouble? Oh, I got a terminal cancer. Yeah. You know, and they know they know time after time.
Yeah.
What's happening? We put signals to them, don't tell me, my God, don't tell me that you're going to die. And you come on with a kind of confidence that, yeah, you're willing to talk about it. Don't talk about it.
I'm going to go to the next one.
of agenda location, I suspect, but I try not to let that bug me. I put this paper together before I even knew where I was going to be on the program, and above all, before I even knew what the man before me was going to do. And therefore, I feel somewhat like a little boy who was going to bring his little glass of water and just pour it out on what he thought was a little piece of garden where it might be useful. And I have suddenly seen that the person on the podium before him has interposed not just one sieve, but three different sieves in which that talk about death and dying has got to go. And I don't know if anything will really come through now in terms of you, death, talk, I, death, talk, it, death, talk. But maybe that can develop in the conversation afterwards. Encountering the last enemy, a theological analysis of death and dying. This expression, death as the last enemy, comes from St. Paul. And most of what I say, in a sense, will be a kind of exegetical conversation with St. Paul in many respects. He says, in his great chapter, interestingly enough, on the resurrection, 1 Corinthians 15, the last enemy to be described is death. In my chapter on resurrection, he is saying many things, not only about the resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth, about the individual resurrection of people who trust that Jesus as the Christ, but about the grand finale, the resurrection at the end of the eon. When the operations of that last day are done, then first, he says, will that last enemy finally be done in. Quote, then shall come to pass the saying that is written, death is swallowed up in victory, quote from Isaiah, a misquote from Isaiah. O death, where is thy victory? O death, where is thy sting? A quote, in fact, even a misquote from Hosea. But now the line that follows, the sting of death is sin, and the power of sin, the strength of sin, is the law. But thanks be to God, who gives us the victory through our Lord Jesus Christ. Okay, how might that ancient word from St. Paul illuminate for us at least some things about the encounter with death? Number one, I think I've got about four parts here. Number one, the one fundamental premise that surfaces here about human life is what I shall label the forensic fact, F-O-R-E-N-S-I-C, I just hear from the word forum. Human life unfolds in the forum, in the marketplace of encounter, response, challenge, reaction, opposition, defense, offense, withdrawal, of bigger or literal or literal situations in which someone stands over against me. Adverse. In that sense, adversary situation. And my own death is an event in that forum. Even though all encounters in the forum are by no means adversary encounters in the sense of an enemy, and thank God they aren't adversary encounters. Nevertheless, the encounter with death is such a one. But is there more to the forensic fact than this, which perhaps an existentially tinted psychologist or even an existentialist kind of sociologist might notice? Indeed, there is. Fundamental to the forensic fact, of course, is God. The nature of human creaturehood is not exhausted by eliminating the various and varied encounters that I have with other creatures, whether they're human creatures, non-human creatures, sometimes even inhuman creatures, whether they're adversary or benign or even neutral toward me, as far as I can tell. But in my creaturely life, fundamentally, I keep on encountering the Creator himself. And that encounter is more than just, for example, the initiating encounter that might have popped me into existence at all. As Christians, in effect, confess in the recycle of the of the sea. We don't just say, I believe that God is the creator of the cosmos, but if we're saying, I believe that, we're saying something about, I believe that he is my creator. The ongoing contact with God is not just that first one that pops me into existence somewhere in the cosmos, that is the ongoing contact which God keeps with his creatures, at least especially his human creatures,
And that contact traditionally is understood as twofold. On the one hand, he keeps my speaking existence going, a sustaining thing, but he also operates evaluatively with me. And in that form contact, that's also going on. I suggest that if man is a moral being, as most of us I suppose would say, the root of that fact of being a moral being lies in the Creator himself, from whom we come, who also does moral evaluation and moral critiquing, and also takes action that is appropriate with his evaluations and his critiquing. Whatever else the Genesis creation stories say in the opening chapters of the Old Testament, they do throw light on the work of God, not only as creator, as the one who says, let there be this and let there be that, but also on God the evaluator. For God, in the first creation account, sort of does a second action. In addition to saying, let there be this, and it is, God then takes a look at it and pronounces it good. And that's the root of a kind of evaluative operation. He both creates and evaluates, and especially does he do so with his human creatures, his images. As Adam and Eve, of course, soon find out in that story, after the fellowship with the Creator was broken, or at least fractured, the new dilemma was that although they would continue to have sort of encounters with the Creator in that form they called the Garden, or at least what the Genesis story qualifies the Garden, the evaluative words that come from God after the break in these encounters are adverse words. And in these conditions, life in the form with God is bad news. Worse still, comes the awareness that even if you move out of Eden, whether by eviction or by some sort of decision on your own, the forensic fact is that you still have to live with creative encounters with the same God. And those encounters are inescapable. Death enters the conversation in the Genesis story, at least as an event, on this form and at this particular place in the forensic encounter. And even though we scientific Westerners are overwhelmingly impressed with the naturalness of death, how many times haven't we heard that phrase this weekend? Perhaps with umpteen different modes of meaning in it here, at least half a dozen different kinds, at least two or three. The Westerners are overwhelmingly impressed with the naturalness of death, and you can envision absurd situations arising if the death of the human beings in the created order had not also been part of the normal procedures. Nevertheless, death is not natural in the vision of the Genesis author, and for St. Paul, it's not natural either. At least human death is not. Because death of images of God is somehow just not part of the original blueprint. It is an ex post facto event that occurs in the form, an event in a sense inflicted by the Creator by virtue of new circumstances of the forensic situation. It's a physical fact, so go back to the death, but it's also a judgmental fact, quote, and Yahweh God said, because of this and because of that, to death we shall return. An evaluative, judgmental, forensic fact. Okay? Part 2, death as my enemy. Death is my enemy, but the last enemy is death. And somewhere in death, God himself has a hand. And that hand is not denied. In the Corinthians text, Paul does not come out and say, as explicitly as I am thinking right now, in death God himself is my enemy. Although there are other Pauline passages which draw this conclusion, even though not quite with the same rhetoric. For example, when Paul is discussing God's regular, normal response to sinners initially. For example, Paul's rhetoric about the ergo tei, the wrath of God, as this as the sixth point. God is finally the sinner's opponent. God is the sinner's critic. God is not the one who affirms to us, first of all, but he's the one who says no to us. He says, in effect, get the hell out of my garden. That's what it is. Get the hell here. That's the most comprehensive no about me. At least the most comprehensive no that I can envision. Committed as Paul is, and I suppose many of us here too, committed as we are to monotheism, to a one-godness, death cannot finally be traced back and rooted in something other than God the Creator. At least somehow, if there's only one God, death has to be under that one umbrella. In the history of ancient Israel, this was apparently a constant temptation provided by many of their renowned Israelite religions, of the neighbors with whom they had fellowship. It would be easy to posit two gods, a life god and a death god. And at that level, God's theism is much more reasonable, or easier to make sense out of reality. Out of the experience antitheses of life and goodness and affirmation that do indeed happen, that of death and evil and conflict and negation and adversary, etc., etc. In the face of this constant tempting alternative, to finally say it makes better sense to have two gods, at least one with whom you can say death, death, and the other one life, the Deuteronomist, as just one Old Testament spokesman, has God himself saying, quote, see now that I am the one, there is no God beside me, I kill, and I make alive. I wound, and I heal, and there is none that can deliver out of my hand. You're stuck in the form. Although the Old Testament picture of death is to be sure variegated, Yahweh's finger in the phenomenon is an item of which ancient Israel is constantly aware. A couple of verses in Psalm 90. You, God, came man back to death, and you say, back to the death, O children of men, for 1,000 years in your sight are like yesterday, and it's passed like one watch in the night. You sweep men away, they're like a dream, like grass, which is new in the morning it flourishes, it's new, but in the evening it fades and withers. We are consumed by your anger, by your wrath, we are overwhelmed. You set our iniquities before you, our secret sins, in the light of your countenance. And thus all our days pass away under thy wrath, our years come to an end like a fire. The years are 2 score and 10, or if I even extend 4 score and 10, yet their strength is tall and subtle, they are soon gone, and we fly away. Who considers the power of your wrath and of your anger according to the fear of you? So teach us to number our days that we may get a heart of wisdom. Yeah, there's a lot more in that than I could even understand, let alone seek to explicate, but I just cite that as another piece of Old Testament data. Yahweh's finger in the picture of death and Yahweh specific. It is worth noting that death is not explained, for example, in that passage in any causal sense of this causes that, or the ultimate cause is finally that Yahweh kind of pulled it a lever or pressed a button. As far as I can perceive, the psalmist apparently would not have bridled at saying the patient died from a massive coronary. That doesn't contradict saying that somehow that leaves God out of the picture. God is not brought into the picture as the fundamental and final factor in a long line of cause-effect. Instead, one might say, using some of our rhetoric, I suppose, that God exercises his criticism of sinners via the biological medium. This biological medium can be seen to have its own internal causal connection, completely comprehended within cause-effect system biologically perceived. And the focus, of course, here is not on just the death of man, especially in Psalm 90, but on the death of a man who is sinner, who, for whatever reason, is outside of Eden. Thus, there can be envisioned the same biological consequences in operation in a man's dying as in the death, for example, of a horse. But man's death is more than the horse's death, just as his life is more than the life of a horse. So his life is a life in that divine form with God as the relational partner. And by that fact, his death is also more than just physical animal terminating. It makes sense to say for many of us that the human creature, like horses and trees, could finally pass away, that a biological organism rises in its life period and it is left down again. And yet, it also doesn't make sense, especially when the human I'm talking about is me. Okay, part three, a closer look at the enemy quality of death. In Peter Ross's book on death and dying, which has been referred to several times, maybe you have read it, maybe you know her. I was in her seminars once when I was a patient, supposedly not terminal, at Billings Hospital in Chicago. She makes a comment without any explicit Christian context or background to it about man's fear of death and the awareness that it's the enemy. She says, page 2, quote, "It is inconceivable for our unconscious to imagine an actual ending of our own life here on earth. And if this life of ours has to end, the ending is always attributed by the unconscious to a malicious intervention from the outside by somebody else. In simple terms, in our unconscious, we can only be killed. It is inconceivable that we just die of natural cause or of old age. At the level of our physical plasticity, death is obviously destroyed. In the disintegration of our body, the destruction becomes physically manifest and leaves no room for the delusion that at least anything of our biological being survives. But, and that question's been speaking around across all afternoon, all weekend, even from Dr. White's casual reference, but then running away from it, is there anything more that does escape the destruction? I normally hear at this point congregations frequently speak these two talking about soul. I don't want to get into that, except to raise this kind of caveat. Yet at this point, Christians, especially those of us in the Western tradition, must proceed cautiously. For it is easy to slip into a Platonic perspective that sees the soul ipso facto as death too, as deception too, as though just by definition, souls can't be killed. But this will not suffice for a Christian to at least work through the, work from some of the data I've just been laying down, as a designation for whatever it is that is something more about man, more than a horse. So in principle, as God's creature, there is nothing about me which in principle is death-proof. Because death-proof in this case means judgment-proof. That there's something in, as though there was something in me which just, if so facto, God himself couldn't critically put the finger to and find it critically cross out. I see a sense of this referred, coming to bear, or at least just casually coming out in one statement of Jesus in the Synoptic Gospels, where Jesus says, rather fear him, than the God, who can destroy both body and soul, as though there's nothing imperfect about soul which makes it immune to God's criticism. When death comes, therefore, biblical writers generally see it as total death. How can the nature of God's verdict be more clearly demonstrated than by that thought? But yet in one sense, it is even worse than that. It is not merely that we do die, but it's that we have to die. We have no choice in the matter. And that observation of leads me then to another, that death is not simply the phenomenon which man meets on the last day of his lifespan. No, the fact that we are here this weekend is illustrative of that. Death has feedback qualities. From the end of my life, from the end, to taking my life now, long before that personal last day of my biographical line. In the language of St. Paul, he specifies this with that term of death rule, death has dominion, death reigns, death is running the show, long before that last day when we are terminated. Man's fear of death, which is one way that death exercises some kind of domination, man's fear of death takes his life long before the fact of death destroys that life. There is another apparent difference between the death of a man and the death of non-human living beings. Awareness of death, consciousness of death, consciousness of the inescapability that we have to die. These facts shape the very line that our lives take as we move toward whatever and whenever that last day is. As I see it, Heidegger, in a kind of secular way, without using the Christian heritage as undergirding, at least explicitly, gives expression to this insight with that one of his many horrendous pretensions in his lingo, the sein zum Tode, being for death, literally, I guess. And now, that sein zum Tode is his label for that particular sort of being that human beings have. My own mortality is a present tense reality. Long before I die, death is exercising regime in my life. And that leads to a fundamental awareness of helplessness, too, in its own way. But even though I may win one battle with a particular sickness or disease, I know already, now I know, that I'm going to lose the war. You can cure mumps or measles or meningitis or even more serious things, but you finally can't cure mortality. With that, I have to get back to St. Paul. There's a equation about death as enemy, sin as death, sin and law as sin's power source. All three of these terms, death, sin, law, are partners in the dilemma of man according to Paul's theology. Without going into extended treatment of these very important things, that deserve that kind of treatment, and that scholars have given treatment to these, I tend to have focused them in a couple of sentences like this: sin, death, law. Sin is Paul's designation for the Adamic solidarity of the whole human race. Adamic, not just Adam, Adamic, but Adam is. The word sin pinpoints the fractured relationship between man and his creator as the root quality of the ongoing life that I cannot escape, as I have to live in the form of God. Men everywhere are automatically Adamic. Automatically, they are like the Adam picture can seem to be. They do not trust God as beneficent father. They do not honestly acknowledge the forensic fact that they have to live with God as donating partners. They have a, you could just say a few different ways perhaps of trying to phenomenologize it. They have a root gen to run their own lives, to run their own show, with little or no reference to the creator judge as he really is in the form in which they have to live. Sin is thus a label for the fact of this ethical structure which continues to be in operation ongoing. Fact. And thus, when man the sinner dies, sin is the scene of his death. Once more, I want to call your attention to that. I think I see there no technical causal connection in any kind of mechanical cause and effect relationship. At least that's not primary. Sin is the scene in man's dying. The real out quality of the death of a man is that it is the death of a sinner. One who's demised is not only a biological being coming to an end, but one whose demise is the greatest critique of a creature who is guilty of bad faith with his creator. And that's the art, that's the sin in the death of man. But what is the sin that its power comes in next word? What is the sin that its clout? Paul's word for that is the law. The law is the clout that sin has. Let that course, as many of you know, law, nomos, is a big, big word. Big umbrella, lots of stuff under nomos. Law designates that whole bag of rubric whereby God regularly relates to his creation and to his human creatures as well. If we just want to focus on death under this large umbrella called law, when we focus on death, the impact, the import of the word law comes to surface as God himself attributing a culpable deed of present faith with him to our bodily person. The connecting link between my sin and my death is the law. The decree and sentence of the judge in the form where I happen to have to stand. Now, all of that is a legal procedure, and there's a lot of, obviously, legal lingo if you're talking about law. Well, God himself and us. Well, God himself is judge, and eventually also executioner, because he is the source of life. All this is encompassed with the word law. Death is a consequence of sin, but not a mechanical consequence. It is rather, if you will, a consequence of guilt. A consequence of a judged culpability. Also, for example, in Romans, Paul can say the wages of sin is death. In other words, the fair and square, the legal, the legitimate, the honest payoff for a sinner is death. Man does not merely die as man, but he dies as a sinner, as a rebel man, in a sense as God's own adversary in the forum. But to that extent, his death is the death of a culture. Which is, I understand, that we're literally of a two-path carrier. It is this quality of his death, arising because he is sinner, which is the unique characteristic of man's death. Were he no sinner, he would not have to die this kind of death. And then, of course, our college bull-questioning minds would say, yeah, what would the death of a non-sinner really look like? That question, though tantalizing, is empirically unanswerable because there is no such man. Even Jesus, by willing to die a sinner's death, gives us no hard data on what the death of a non-sinner might look like. Part 4, and that is the last part. Encountering this enemy, with and without Christian resources, the last enemy is death. The last enemy in my own biography. And in 1 Corinthians 15, Paul is talking about death as sort of the last enemy in the whole cosmos, in the cosmos's biography. This is what Paul is discussing in 1 Corinthians 15. By virtue of the factor, and by virtue of God's fair and square lawful operations with sinners, death is the last enemy. Of course, 1 Corinthians 15 is about resurrection, Christ's resurrection, the resurrection of those who are Christ connected. In fact, that's the major theme of Paul's chapter 15. But I hear him saying, you don't see what a victory you've really got in this resurrected Christ unless you see the full enemy for all that he, for all that death really is. And the fullness of the enemy is that he is indeed invincible, at least with my resources, because in encountering him, I finally encountered my own Creator operating against me. So any alternative to that death will have to finally come from that same source. And Paul's doxology at the end of this, thanks be to God who gives us the victory through our Lord Jesus Christ, that doxological conclusion expresses on the one hand the focus as well as the locus, the flare, so that the way of the source, where is that victory? Where do you come from, if there is any at all, in the face of this particular enemy? And as doxology, it also expresses, in a sense, Paul's almost surprise that the victory came at all from that source at all. Given the full truth about who I am, about what's really going on in the forum between God and sinners, and about what therefore death is. And so, thanks be to God who gives us the victory. He doesn't just say, hey, here's where the victory comes, but, and a surprise, surprise, he would have guessed it. Of course, there are other options used, and always have until that grand finale that Paul's talking about, other options that the human race and individuals and groups of them will use for coming to terms with death. Our own contemporary age has been consistently criticized in the last few years for its very obvious attempt at repression or suppression or just hiding death under the sweet humor culture of the American way of death, for example, or that we treat death via pornographic procedures. Dr. Gray's term and article. Or that we construct procedures even that don't seem maliciously to want to hide death, but which nevertheless amount to doing so anyhow. That we hospitalize dying persons, even though at least consciously we're not doing it. I know I've got to get them out there so nobody will see them. But that does remove death also from public view. Henry Kulicher, in a book called Death and Life, published last year by Hershey's Press, translated by me as a kind of filial token of duty to my justice father at the University of Hamburg. Henry Kulicher has come upon what he calls a kind of model for non-Christian Weltanschauungen in the a kind of standard option that frequently at least appears in non-Christian alternatives for how to come to terms with death. And his model says, the procedure is to try to divide the human eye, the human self, into a sort of real me and then a kind of fellow traveler me. You can tell these are my first two translations for what in German is das eigentliche Ich und das uneigentliche Ich. I forgot even what I used as the technical words. I didn't use in the translation the real me and the fellow traveler me, but maybe I should have. That seems more comprehensible right now to me. And then the procedure is you posit immortality, deathlessness, to the real me, and allow us how the fellow traveler me does indeed go down into the grave, it does go down in death. Plato does this with his concept of immortal soul in a very clear way. The body is mortal, but that's not the real me. The real me is my psyche, soul, and that's the one that's by definition deathless. Classical idealism and romanticism, at least the German versions especially, each in its own way, classes in the same way, that kind of X in every man, the real sin, who is death to. And Kulicher even says that the official mythos of National Socialism in Germany, insofar as it was a enunciated philosophy, also followed the same pattern. Let me just read you a paragraph or two right here to let Kulicher do the talking. After that, I got one page. It's in a section called Two Stopgap Solutions, right? These four paragraphs. And this is Kulicher's way of, with this matter in mind, he takes a look again at what he was trying to see, and that at this time was sort of Europe of the early 40s. This is written after doing the Second World War. On the one hand, men may attempt to relieve the relentless pressure of the problem of death by positing one particular value as absolute, and then by a conscious act of the will, refusing to inquire whether there is any other reality which might still transcend that and finally call that into question. Such an attempt is precisely what is involved in all the talk here in Germany about our nature as something eternal and indestructible, 1940 Germany. Here the act of absolutizing is especially obvious, and then it is but a logical consequence which imperceptibly and by degrees ceases. And then it is but a logical consequence when, imperceptibly and by degrees, the ultimate criterion of good and evil becomes simply whether or not something is useful and beneficial for this nation, which has been absolutized. On the other hand, that's what we call one stopgap solution. On the other hand, men may attempt to see the meaning of life not in some single, supposedly absolute aspect which they have posited for themselves, but in the infinite parade of life's finite reality. We have a fascinating analysis of David Faust under that rubric. the infinite parade of life's finite realities, each one regarded as a fragmentary parable for the totality of life. Which, though hidden in the background, is nevertheless symbolically present to determine the meaning of that whole procession, and you at least see a snippet of it in each individual conclusion. To fulfill the meaning of one's life, then, is surrender, as Faust does, from one entity to the next, in a diligent and unending search, never coming to any absolute cause and supposedly achieved goal. In either case, a man's mortal life is absorbed into an overarching higher configuration of meaning. In the first case, man thinks of this configuration of meaning statically, as a particularly concretely posited telos. Humanity, the nation, some worth or value. In the second, instead of statically, he thinks in dynamic terms, as what the totality of the universe discloses, and it does disclose itself only as the man struggles and wanders through that land. Either way, if he could succeed in pulling it off, he could then demonstrate that death belongs integrally to life. Death would no longer be something alien, contradictory, confusing, an enemy. As ultimate and terminal finality, death itself would thereby be rendered impotent, no sight, no trivial, just as, of course, God himself was rendered impotent, null, and trivial, when he is accommodated to us, when he is made to conform to our notions of what reality must have to be. Vis-a-vis both of these, death circumcised and God circumcised, man no longer dies completely, in contradiction to the biblical affirmation, but he remains essentially intact. He just undergoes transition into that manifestation of life which is indigenously authentic, identically, for him. The fallacy which Christian theology detects in the variety of ways which man in our day, if it's man in our day, seeks to come to terms with death is manifold. I mean, there are many things that could be said, and I'm only going to say about two. Basically, all of the modes, and I didn't find out very many of them concretely, basically all of the modes are sub-gospel. And Christian theology says, if anything is sub-gospel, it finally won't work. Finally it won't. It really won't work, finally, to give man victory, for example, over the last enemy. God's own criticism just won't stay repressed indefinitely by any immortality scheme. And in a sense, I see Peter Ross sort of pointing that out again, as he came to that idea or that observation, I don't know. But without any Christian resource, he says the unconscious, we can't understand itself dying because an enemy that comes from the outside and wipes it out. God's own criticism won't stay repressed by any immortality scheme, probably something that's death-less, death-free, by any immortality scheme other than that immortality which has been brought to life in the resurrection of Jesus himself from the dead. And in a sense, that's technically not immortality, but that's going through mortality and then coming out victor. It's not bypassing mortality via some scheme, but going through death, total death, and yet coming out on the other side, resurrected, recreated. And of course, that brings us back to 1 Corinthians 15 again, because for this reason, the fundamental fallacy inherent in any sub-gospel alternative to the gospel is not simply it's insufficient to take care of the real problem, but it's also, if you opt for an alternative that is sub-gospel in place of the gospel, in effect this amounts to a distrust of the gospel. So that, a distrust of that one good word that God himself gives to us, for us to be victorious over the last enemy. And of course, here then the church of the South began. To distrust God's gospel, we've got another enactment of God's faith on our part in the form and the cycle of events that engenders my assignment to describe this victory over death, which is actually the main theme of 1 Corinthians 15. Maybe we can get into that some more a little in the conversation, or maybe Daniel will call our attention to that in our closing worship. Or you can read it in 1 Corinthians 15 yourself and do your own meditating. Nor did I take it as my task, and I might have, if I had known what was going to happen before in the conference program, to at least spend more time on this, but I didn't. I did not take it as my task to describe this victory much, or to work out some of the internal operations that Paul at least seeks to illuminate for us, nor to show how that might work and how that does work. As a realistic resource for our own encountering all our enemies, and for our coming out, use the lingo of Bob Bacon last night, coming out winners instead of losers, even though there can be no denial that we stay bound in the struggle. Instead, I started my presentation rather with the episode of reconnoiter the enemy, and see what fuller truth, if not yet the full truth, what the fuller truth about death really is. The fuller truth about death, fuller at least than those pictures which bypass this forensic fact as they seek to illuminate what's really happening. And how many times have you had that phrase over the weekend? Now, what's really going on in death? The fuller truth about death, fuller at least than those pictures which bypass this forensic fact, the fuller truth is that my Creator encounters me as an adversary in a situation that I cannot handle. But although this is the fuller truth about death, it is not the fuller truth about God. Going back to Bob Bacon for the story last night, or dialogue. God's last word to me and about me is Jesus Christ, crucified and resurrected, pro me, pro vidi, for me, for you, for us. And with that last word, and the full truth about the Creator, I actually can be liberated, not only from death, sin, and strife, but also from the hang-ups that might inhibit me from even admitting that that is the full truth.